Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. First of all, I'd like to thank you for coming out to the Tattered Cover Bookstore and supporting your locally owned and independent businesses. I'm pleased to introduce this evening's guest speaker, author Dora Levy-Mossonen. Dora has made herself an international best-selling author with her previous work, Courtesan and Harem, translated, I believe, into 7 different languages at this time. 16? Oh, wow. I was counting on your website, and it looked like 7. 16 different languages. That is way better than 7. So, again, she's become an international household name with her previous work. When she's not writing novels, Dora blogs on the Huffington Post and writes fiction reviews for Jewish Journal. Tonight, Dora is here to present her newest novel, The Last Romanov. And reviews for The Last Romanov have been turning out great words such as engaging, bejeweled, engrossing, and many, many more. If you haven't looked at the reviews, you should do so. So the Tattered Cover is very happy to have her back. It's been a long time. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Dora Levy-Mossonen.
Thank you, Beth, and thank you, Charles, and The Tattered Cover for having me here for the third time. It's like my second home. And one of the few, I'm afraid to say, bookstores that are still standing and so supportive. So thank you. And of course, I want to extend a special thanks to my wonderful sister, Laura, and to David, who always, indeed, have made me feel so welcome here in Denver. Thank you. I thought what I'll do is just give you a brief introduction to what inspired me to write The Last Romanov, perhaps read a small section from my book, and then I would like to open the forum to any questions you may have. So you might not believe this, but this book has been brewing and simmering and cooking and perhaps even frying in my head for more than 2 decades. Since the day 1991 when I read in the news that the remains of the Romanovs were discovered. It was a major discovery because the remains were discovered after 73 years. But although more than 1,000 burned acid-drenched bone fragments were exhumed, the mystery surrounding the Bolshevik execution of Tsar Nicholas II, Tsarina Alexandra, and their 5 children was not solved because 11 people were murdered at the cellar of the Ipatiev house in Yekaterinburg. Only 9 skulls, though, were discovered. Forensic anthropologists went to work, and after the lengthy process of skeleton identification and DNA testing, they came back and announced that one of the 2 missing bodies belonged to Alexei Nikolaevich, the Tsarevich, who was heir to the 300-year throne, Romanov dynasty. Did the Tsarevich survive, I wondered? And if so, would he be in a position to reinstate the Romanov dynasty? That question touched me in a very personal way because not only myself, but perhaps many of my expatriates, I believe, still ask, what if the Islamic Republic is overthrown and the Pahlavi dynasty is brought back? And this was a question that basically, the context of the Romanovs and the Bolshevik uprising, was the seed that bloomed into the last Romanov. I was fascinated by every emerging detail. Why did the Tsar neglect to take care of his teeth? While the Tsarina had sophisticated dental work, even porcelain crowns, and I don't know if any one of you have had porcelain crowns, but I had just a couple of months ago, and believe me, it's very sophisticated work. So I don't know how. And then I wondered, why did the Tsar and Tsarina welcome Rasputin into their home? Not only that, but into the private quarters of their daughters. Was it true that Alexandra had an affair with Rasputin, this mad monk who was known to be a womanizer? I went ahead and studied hemophilia, the lethal disease that struck to the heir to the Romanov dynasty. And I learned about the incredible decadence and pomp that was going on in the court while outside most of the populace was in abject poverty and even were having a hard time feeding their families. I think I was about halfway through my book when I learned a very important lesson. I was halfway through my book, had developed passion, empathy, even love towards my characters, when I learned the dangers of falling in love with your characters, no matter how long you have lived with them. It was at this time that my father of blessed memory, who unfortunately did not live to see this book come to fruition, came to me and said, "Dora, what are you writing about?" I said, "I'm writing about the Romanovs." He looked me straight in the eye and laid the guilt on thick. And when I say thick, thick. He said, "My own flesh and blood is writing about those anti-Semites." He had a point. We had survived the Israeli War of Independence, where my father had fought. We had survived the 1953 coup d'etat of Dr. Mossadegh, the 1979 Islamic Revolution. We had lived in Iran, where we had experienced our own fair share of prejudice. Why would I write about an imperial family who showed no compassion towards their Jewish communities? A few heartbeats passed, I collected my thoughts. I turned to my father and I said, "Papa, my book is much more than the history of a decadent court with a tragic ending. I have planted my own Esther and Mordechai in this court. My Esther as an opal eye, she has healing powers. She falls in love with Avram. He's a Jewish artist. He is her conscience. He becomes a spokesman for the Jews. I'm an author, Papa. I can do that, I promise you." So my father looked at me, he nodded, he smiled. He freed me. He freed me to go ahead and draw from the different cultures that I've experienced, to weave my own fictional characters among epic historical figures. And I hope I've managed to do that, to set an intimate understanding of a decadent court that was steeped in superstition, in myth, but more than anything, unbelievable, unbelievable denial. So I thank you. I am going to read just a very short excerpt from my book and then to your questions. I usually don't read from my book, but I don't know, so many ask, so I thought I'll try. So this is a practice. "A drop of blood blossoms in his navel, bubbling like a tiny underground well. The six-week-old Tsarevich is bleeding. The Empress presses her lips to her son's chest, slides a trembling finger across the blood warming down his belly. Moonpale and slightly out of breath, her eyes seek the icons crowding her room to rest on the image of Our Lady of Zarskoe Selo. Falling to her knees in front of her favorite saint, her lips move in silent prayer. She rests her wet cheeks on the lady's image, begging forgiveness. She had prayed too hard for a son, begged for an heir to the throne, forced God into submission, and he punished her by giving her a sick Tsarevich. Daria changes the blood-soaked gauze on the infant's abdomen, adds dry ones, and secures them with bandages. Her bones feel brittle as icicles from the hissing fire in the heart. Although it is not yet cold outside, doctors have ordered the fires to keep the baby warm. The Empress goes back to her son and bundles him in her arms, as if to tuck him back into her womb. It is here, in the lilac boudoir, that she comes to escape official protocol and royal intrigue, to pass quiet time with her children, and to share evening tea with her husband. Her sanctuary is decorated in the Victorian style. The fabric was selected to match a lily the Tsar once gave her. New styles come and go, but this room remains as it was when the imperial couple's wedding night. Despite tremendous disappointment of the press for selecting a British design for a bedroom, the Tsar shares with the Tsarina. Those were happier times. Her son is diagnosed with hemophilia now, an incurable disease, an inherited blood clotting deficiency transmitted by women, the doctors tell her, a capricious disease that rarely afflicts women. Among 5,000 males, one is struck with a bleeding disease, and God chose her son. No one is able to predict how often the bleeding will occur or how long it will last before the blood coagulates. Patience is suggested. A mother has the right to be impatient. Heal him, Daria. Heal my son. Stop this terrible bleeding.
Thank you.
All right, any questions? I'm here, ready and able to answer. Yes.
First, I love your style of writing. It's beautiful. I'm sorry, I haven't read anything here.
Thank you. Well, Rasputin, as we have learned in more modern times, had hypnotic power. And he was able, by calming the young Tsarevich and his mother, to stem the bleeding. But for the Tsarina and the entire royal family, what they thought was that he had magical powers. And superstition was rampant. The empress went out to all types of wandering monks and magicians and brought them in to see if they could heal her son. So there was tremendous superstition that, and myth about everything that was going on in the court. Yes.
First of all, I must compliment you. You read like an actress.
Oh, thank you. Well, actually, it was a feudal system. And then they were trying, Nicholas II was forced in a way. I think he moved very slowly. He was not a very smart man. And he moved very slowly. And he was trying to create a more modern system wherein, I believe, with a series of revolutions that happened, they had maybe 10 or 11 Dumas, which is like our Congress, come one after the other. And the sad thing here was that the Tsar left the capital and went to the front with his soldiers during war and left the capital at the mercy of his wife and Rasputin, who were making political decisions, one wrong decision after another. So that definitely helped the downfall of the Romanovs. That's right. You know, it perhaps this was one of the most tumultuous eras in Russian history. And for me, as a writer, to bring the political landscape into clarity for the reader was quite challenging because there were a series, first of all, years of unrest, a series of revolutions. There was the Russo-Japanese War, World War I, and then the rise of the Bolsheviks. And it's confusing. So I really hope that I've managed to give a clear understanding of what happened and what resulted in the fall of the Romanovs. Yes. Right, that's true.
So I would say that this book by Trevor Loudon, and you can go to trevorloudon.com, shows us that communism doesn't work. And this exposes Obama and all his communist connections. So if you will not look at this,
I think. All right. I think we won't become that political maybe tonight. All right.
Yes. Just knowing from your perspective how the Romanovs connect with what you see in Iran and the, I don't know the name of the...
Mohammad Reza Shah and Pahlavi era. I think that it was the denial. I think the Shah was also in denial. And up to the very end when he left, he thought that it might be a situation similar to the Mossadegh coup d'etat, where he was, you know, he went to Italy and was brought back by his American allies. So, and I believe that up to the very last minute when the Romanovs were walked into the cellar of the Ipatiev house, or the house of special purpose, that's what it was called, they thought that the White Army was close and they would be freed. So it's mostly that denial. Yes. No, actually what's interesting is they did not know whether it was Anastasia or it was Maria. But of course, as we know, it became Anastasia. The stories, the books, the pretenders just came from every corner. In 2007, another grave was discovered, and actually both Alexei's remains and Maria's remains were discovered. But this is just a few years ago. Yeah. Yes.
Hi. You spoke about the deep religious feeling that you had looking for icons. And it seems to be somewhat in contrast then with being under the spell of Rasputin. I understand he was a monk, but how did religion really play?
Oh, Rasputin was, in a way, he was he was smart. You know, we have an image of Rasputin as if he's a mad monk and only a womanizer. But he was very smart and able to manipulate especially Alexandra. And, you know, Nicholas and Alexandra were very much in love. So he came from the religious side. Everything was religious. When he would give her advice, it was, you know, God is saying that, or the saints have predicted such and such. So he was very much connected with the religion in that way. Yes.
Do
Romanovs, I see them as figureheads most of their ruling years. Who actually ran things during that era?
With the establishment of the Duma, Nicholas became a figurehead. But before that, he was not that he ruled the country. He didn't make the right decisions. But it was only after the series of revolutions and Black Sunday, which was perhaps what catapulted the country into more major revolutions and all of that. I think it was then that little by little his responsibilities were in a way taken away from him, and the Duma was making more of the decisions. But Dumas never lasted, and that was a major problem because Alexandra, because of Rasputin's advice, was firing one after the other members of the Duma. Yes.
Could you share some of your process as a writer? I mean, here you are getting into this huge realm of research and then creating a story.
Well, indeed, I believe that my research started 20 years ago. And I usually start my research years before the book because there's an era that interests me, fascinates me, and I move and I begin to research that. But my research never stops while I'm writing, and this book took about 4 years to write. I'm still researching. And for example, when the second grave was discovered in 2007, I thought, I have a big problem because the remains of Alexei have been discovered. But my book starts in 1991 with the fall of communism, and it ends in 1991. So I could deal with, I didn't have to then deal with, yeah. But research, I mean, it is beyond belief. And nowadays, as you know, we have so many different ways of, for Harem, I was in the library every day. But now online, I still like to read books, very much so for research. But online, there's a plethora of rich detail that you can get. I have walked every one of the palaces that I write about virtually. I have walked. I know every corner. I know all the furniture. I know the carpets, the drapes, everything. Well, the question was, if Alexei survived, would he be in a position to bring back the toppled Romanov dynasty? And still, the question for me, and I know many others, is, what if the Pahlavi dynasty is brought back and the Islamic Republic is toppled? Am I being too daring here? Yes. Sorry.
Is that what intrigued you about this era versus other eras to devote so much energy to? Because thinking about this for 20 years, what stimulated
you? I am very interested in decadent eras that sort of implode. And this is what happened here. This was not an easy book to research, as I said, because of the political situation that was happening. There were hundreds of small revolutions that gathered force to become the big revolution where eventually the Bolsheviks came. I cannot tell you how many factions existed. just to study all these factions is beyond belief. And if you look at all my other books, harem, in a way, you know, ancient times and inside the harem and outside, there is tremendous decadence also, as is during the Belle Epoque in courtesan. I don't know what to say. There's things that happen that fascinate me, and I think, ooh, if I want to learn about this period, then I should write about it, because that's the only way that will make me to really research it very deeply and learn about it. Yes, Dave. What are you going to ask? Now I'm scared. David, what is it that only you can ask?
As a wife, mother, now grandmother, you have so much responsibility. And to be able to do the research, and I know throughout the years you have been studying the subject, what is the driving force? There must be that driving force that separates you from many other people.
Well, I'll give you two answers. One is a driving force, and one I don't know what to call it. On one side is neglect. I have to neglect a lot of things in my life to be able to do this. That's on one side. This is the truth.
But I know firsthand that you haven't neglected your kids.
I have not. So these are only my kids, my grandkids, and my husband. I would pick up the phone. And if I am needed, I will be there. But believe me, there's such a larger circle of, thank God, I'm blessed with around me, that I have to neglect. But to your real question, there is a passion. I have to do this. If I don't do it, I am not in my elements. I'm antsy. I'm not happy. So I have to do it. And I have to do it, but I'm also, you know, to finish a book, you have to persevere. And to write, you know, we write at home. It's not a 9-to-5 job. So you have to have tremendous discipline. And I'm not saying that I don't get up in the morning and then I have coffee and then I think, okay, I read my papers and then, oh, do I need this? Maybe I should do that. But eventually I get myself to the computer. So that requires tremendous discipline, you know. So I hope I answered your question. Yes. You go ahead. That's true.
And perhaps you can comment on this, your perspective on their involvement in this whole scenario.
Well, no question that they were anti-Semites, and no question that there were tremendous pogroms taking place. And even Theodore Roosevelt, the president, sent a letter to Nicholas and said, you know, stop your oppression of the Jews, which not only he did not reply to, but even caused more havoc. So, and this is where my problem entered into, as I said, into writing this book. I had not thought about that. I am a Jewish writer, and I had a dilemma, which I hope that I solved in a, you know, in a good way. Yeah. Yes. Oh, it's unbelievable. Unbelievable. Sorry.
When you finish a book, is there elation and happiness that it's done, or is there a sadness and a feeling of loss? And is it different because you've written other books? And you change
No, it doesn't change, and it's definitely a mixture of feelings. I have lived with my charges for so many years. I don't want to give them, I don't want to say goodbye. Having said that, there is tremendous happiness that, oh, have I really finished this book? Is it finished? I disbelief. Let me go have a glass of wine, which I always do. But it takes me a long time to let go. Because I've lived with them, I know them so well, and you know. But it's a good thing. It's now we go to the next, hopefully. What's next? Okay, I can't stay away long from Iran, so I'm going back to Iran during World War II, and I know very much about that era now, of course, and my protagonist is a Jewish dentist who is the Jewish of the Shah, and we will see where it goes from there. Yes? Yes. Well, I hope I've managed to create that authentic dialogue, but that goes back to research again. To the you research the character of your historical figures, you know, if you and the language of the time and the dialect of the time and the way they spoke and the way that specific person spoke. You know, Alexandra was very, very shy person, and she was also very formal. And so you try to recreate that. Hopefully you succeed. Yeah. I don't know. Do we have time, Beth?
I think we have time for maybe four questions.
Okay. Go ahead, please.
With all your research, did you have one really big surprise or was it a multitude?
Oh my God, it was a multitude of surprises. Was unbelievable. I mean, just the scene that I read for you, it was the first time that Alexandra and Nicholas find out that their son is hemophilic. And just imagine, you know, bleeding from the navel. Unbelievable. And the way they were murdered. I mean, I don't care how anti-Semitic they were or whatever. I mean, it's heart-wrenching the way they were murdered. And the pomp and the decadence in that court was beyond belief, and one surprise after the other. And this is what attracts me, you know, this is what fascinates me. Then I love to learn more and more about that. Yes. Oh, you know, I don't know. Everything could happen again. They say history repeats itself. I know it's, but it could. What shall I say? I mean, I think even in Iran, when the Shah crowned himself and the Empress, you know, that also helped to bring about his downfall, because there was a population of poor that indeed, like in Russia, could not feed their families. And then they see this pomp and decadence and this luxury and stunning parties and going on. You know, it could perhaps happen.
So,
my sister.
Your sister.
I want to share. I want to say how proud I am.
Oh,
of you.
I love you.
How very, very proud. Not only because of the three amazing books that you have written, but what Dora hasn't talked about is the whole publishing side of it. As you can imagine, can be such a nightmare, and how she persevered with that. And the two other books you have written that, God willing, soon will get published too. But you have to understand, you need to put this in perspective. Dora, like me, comes from a background that really didn't look at women being independent very favorably. So what she had to go through to make this happen and to get her master's degree, and as English being a second language to do this, and on, and living in a Middle Eastern country with chauvinist men. Oh, my goodness. No. The perseverance really goes beyond just being disciplined and writing and sending it out and getting rejection letter after rejection letter and keep at it and keep at it and keep revising the book. It really also goes to our background, our culture, what it meant to be a woman from that culture, what it meant to be a Jewish woman from that culture. So keep all of that in mind when you think, when you read Dora's book. So meanwhile, what Dora's friends and family are doing is to show support not only for Dora, we want her book to become a bestseller, because it's really then that the publishing houses will then accept her fourth book into being printed with open arms. So we want to do everything we can to make sure that her book becomes a bestseller. It already has gone into second publishing, and Dora is too humble to mention that. Mm-hmm. That's huge. The book just came out this month. That's huge. So we are on our way to make it a bestseller. And it's not only good to make sure that Dora can continue to write and get published, but it's important for Tattered Cover, places like here, so that we can all support them.
Yes.
So even if it's available at Amazon, do help support our local business.
Yes.
It makes a great gift. It's a great gift. There are no limits how many copies you can get. So buy it for your friends and family. Thank you so much.
I love it.
Thank you. Thank you.
I have to start.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.